Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. We will be talking tonight with various guests, and we will start out with Tal Cohen, the representative to the United States for Tabor Winery from Israel, one of Israel's fastest up-and-coming boutique wineries. Good evening, Tal. Are you there?
I'm here, Chaim, and thank you for having me on the show.
Okay, with the Passover holiday almost on top of us, tell us a little bit about Tabor Winery and what wine recommendations would you make both for the four cups and for during the meal. But start a little bit with the history of Tabor Winery, the history of wine in Israel in general.
And with pleasure. Well, first of all, we know that wine is probably one of the oldest industries in Israel. There's been, you know, the first signs of wine is about 4,000 years ago. But in the late 18th, beginning of 1900, Baron Rothschild came to Israel and recreated the wine industry after a long ban on production of grapes for wine. And one of the places that he built was Ksar Tabor, an agricultural settlement with the sole purpose of growing grapes for wine. So he brought in the first kinds of grapes, the Chardonnay, the Merlot, the Cabernet, and the wine industry started over again. In 1999, four families from Ksar Tabor that had been grape growers for wine for centuries decided to open their own winery, and that is Tabor Winery. And as you said, it's probably the fastest growing boutique winery in Israel. It produces more than 1 million bottles of wine annually now. You tasted Tabor in one of our tastings that we had in
one of the tastings, yes.
Yes, and you see, you know that we have three main categories of wine. We have our everyday wine that we call the Galil line, which is a younger 4 months old wine that has a Merlot, a Cabernet, and a Shiraz. And it also has a Sauvignon Blanc, and it has an un-oaked Chardonnay. And that line is a beautiful line of wine that are very, very tasty and fruity and very light and delicious. And these wines I can definitely see as part of the Seder evening, because we're drinking so many glasses of wine that we do really want a wine that is fun and enjoyable to drink. I would go even further.
Well, we want a wine that is not too heavy, because if it's too heavy, obviously the people are going to get sleepy or they may get sick. At the same time, you want a wine that you can feel there is some wine to it. You don't want one of those very, very bland wines. You want something with some taste to it.
Exactly. And that's where the Galil line is perfect. And I would go further and say that if I had to choose two bottles of wine to have at the first part of the Seder evening on the table, it would probably be the Galil Chardonnay for the ones who like the white wine. And it's un-oaked, it's fruity, you get the grapefruit, you have a lot of aromas, and it's a really, really, truly beautiful wine. And then we have Tabor's new wine, which is the Shiraz. It's a new wine that we introduced this year to the market, and that's a fabulous wine. It's very, very fruity. The nose is wonderful. The taste is great. And it's just the perfect wine to have a couple of glasses of it during the Seder. So that's definitely, and you got to taste the Shiraz last week.
Absolutely.
And both options are great bottles of wine for $15. I mean, that's more or less the price of the Galil line. So you get a great value for your money in both of these wines. I do want to say, Chaim, that one of the very, very nice trends that I really enjoy in the last couple of years is to see that the Seder table is moving away from having kosher wines on it because it's kosher, to having great kosher wines because you can today choose from a variety of wines from all over the world, and people choose great, tasty wines. So this is not the traditional horrible kosher wines that people used to have on the table, but these are really delicious wines. And I think that Israeli wines bring so much to the table, and it's a great way to support Israel and support the Israeli wine industry by having, you know, Israeli wines on the Seder table.
Absolutely.
Now,
yeah. If we go up in price a little bit, what would you suggest? And also, let's do some pairings. Let's face it, the food that we eat during the Seder, on the one hand, we have things like mahor, very, very spicy. Some people, Europeans especially, it used to happen in my home, unlike Americans, which put the mahor, they put it on the fish every Erev Shabbat, we used to put it directly on the meat. So on
right.
the one hand, you have a very, very heavy meat and a very, very spicy thing that you put on it. What wine would you pair it with?
Yeah. Well, for the dinner, once we are over, you know, the glasses and the Seder and everything, and everyone has eaten and has had a great time and we have sung the songs, we're going over to the dinner. And for the dinner, we definitely move from the Galil series into the Adama series. Adama means soil, and this is our soil series where we actually pick the grapes separately from the different types of soil the vineyard is on. And Tabor is located on both volcanic soil, which is basal soil, on clay soil, terra rosa, and chalk soil. So we have two Merlots and two Cabernets that are volcanic, terra rosa, and chalk soil. And the uniqueness of this series is that every one of these wines is distinctly different in taste, in heaviness, in body, from, you know, one another, which gives us two great points. One is that everyone can find a wine that they really enjoy, but also that it's easier to pair it with the different meals that we have on the table. For example, chalk soil, we have an amazing chalk soil Merlot. A chalk soil is a soft soil, it's earthy, it's low in minerals, the grapes are full of flavor, and the wine is a soft tannin, a bit spicy wine, very well balanced, has both some sweetness and some sourness to it. So we get all in all a very delicate, powerful wine. This one I would definitely pair with the fish course. Some houses have the traditional gefilte, but some houses have, you know, tomato-based, chalaima kind of spicy fish. What's nice about this is that it can go, because it has the sweetness and the sourness, it can really go with any type of fish dish that you have at the beginning of the meal. This wine is also really nice for any type of tagine or slow-cooked chicken or turkey dish that is spiced nicely. And I think it's a beautiful wine. If we move into the meat portions of the evening, there we have two wines that would go perfectly with meaty dishes. We have the Terra Rosa Cabernet. Terra Rosa, again, is a soft soil, but this time if the chalk soil is more a low mineral kind of soil, then the Terra Rosa is dark red soil with a lot of iron in it that gives both the wine and the soil this very deep red color. This soil is very rich in minerals, and this transfers to the wine, and we get a very bold, delicious, well-balanced wine. It's almost a symphony of flavors and aromas, and I think from, you know, a lot of people around me that have tasted this, this is really a surprising wine. It's very powerful, And it's very, very rich, but it also gives you a kind of a round, well-balanced wine. This one, I would definitely accompany the dishes that you are talking about. The very spicy, very bold flavor dishes, whether it's, you know, a lamb or some kind of beef that has all the spices, you know, the pepper and everything around it, you get a beautiful combination of a great wine with a great dish. Another wine that is very, very nice accompanied with meat is the Volcanic series. We have a Volcanic Merlot and a Volcanic Cabernet. When you look at volcanic soil, which is a very, very hard, rocky soil, it's amazing to imagine how grapes can grow in this soil. But you actually get very, very nice fruity wines out of this. The Adama series is oaked in French and American oak for 12 months. You have a very, very strong vanilla nose on the volcanic soils. You have lots of blackberries and red berries. It's very earthy wine. You taste the minerals in it. And it definitely stays with you long after you've finished your glass of wine. This is, once again, a wine that goes very nicely with meat dishes, you know, any kind of beef, any kind of lamb dish that is nicely spiced, whether it's slow cooked or whether it's in the oven. I think these kind of combinations are just wonderful. Another thing that I would say about the volcanic soil wine is that once you get to the dessert part, these wines are beautiful. The volcanic Cabernet is beautiful with either a chocolate-based dessert or fruit-based dessert. The sweetness of the dessert and the richness of the wine are really a wonderful combination that are just really magnificent together.
Okay. Fine. Now, yes. Now, tell us. tell us a little bit about the price ranges of the last wines that we've spoken of.
Well, the Adama series are on the shelf at about $20. One of the philosophies of the winery, the Boer Winery, is to be great value for money. We don't do these overpriced bottles of wine, you know, $80, $100. And although it is nice occasionally to have an expensive bottle of wine, I think that for $15 to $20, you can get a wonderful variety of wines. That Adama series, some places might be up on, you know, $22, $24, but these are very, very, very good wines. And I have no doubt that anyone that will pick up a bottle of Adama will really, truly enjoy it. That Adama Volcanic Soil Cabernet got an 89 from the Wine Spectator. Daniel Rogov, who's a wonderful wine critique, reviews these wines every year and gives them, you know, 90 and above marks, and really enjoys these wines as well, and I think that anyone will enjoy them. We do have the Mescha wine, which is our top-of-the-line wine. It's 24 months oaked. It's a blend of Cabernet, Merlot, and Shiraz. That is a price point of about $32. It's a wonderful wine, but I really think that when you have so much wine and food during a dinner, the Mescal is sort of a standalone wine that you really, you know, it's a different kind of occasional wine to really just sit and enjoy the wine for itself. During the Seder evening, I would start out with the Galil, I would move on to the Adama, and really just have it accompany a really great evening. I mean, Seder is one of the best family evenings that we can have.
Absolutely. Now, let's talk a little bit in general about you've told us, okay, how you would pair your wines with the different foods. Now, let us imagine for a second that you are preparing a very, very fancy dinner. Okay? So give us a short description of the fancy dishes and the wines that will accompany them.
And ooh, now I have to,
for the audience,
I have to prepare fancy dinner.
What?
I have to prepare fancy dinner?
Let us imagine that you do. After, don't worry, we won't get the whole audience to become your guests for the fancy dinner. I promise you, we won't.
Well, I have
imagine
to
that you're preparing a fancy dinner, and now let's pair it with some of your wines.
Okay. Well,
let's
I
make
can,
that a special evening. And as for the audience, let's bear in mind that you do not need to have an expensive wine to have a great wine. Tabor is absolutely the proof that a great wine does not need to be expensive.
Right. Well, first of all, my husband will love this question you asked me, because in our house, most of the food, he's the chef in the house. And he's an amazing, extraordinary chef in the house. So I can tell you what he will prepare and how I compare the wines to it.
Okay.
And in our house, we do start, the fish course is usually a tomato-based, it's one of two. It's either very well-spiced tomato-based fish that we really like both year-round and during Passover. And there I would pair it with the chalk soil adama. And then in the meat, we usually have either a slow roast in the oven with a lot of rosemary and a lot of spices on top of it with some pepper. Or we have a tagine style slow-cooked meat. And in both cases, I think that the Terra Rosa would work beautiful with this kind of food. And then when we get to the last part of the evening, which is the desserts, that's usually my department. I make a chocolate cake, I make it year-round because it's both gluten and dairy-free, and it's a wonderful cake that is almost like a mousse cake. And that one I like to pair with the Shiraz because of the fruitiness of the Shiraz. That works really, really nicely with the cake, all with the volcanic adama. In all of my tastings, I always do at the end a pairing of chocolate and wine, because chocolate really brings out a lot of flavors from the wine when you eat them together. So I would go for this kind of a dinner. At home, we are really more meat eaters, at least me and my kids, and it always has to be slow-cooked, deliciously spiced meats, and that's where the Adama series is absolutely a perfect pairing for that. That's the way I would go. In the first part of the dinner, we definitely will have both Chardonnay and Shiraz on the table because it's just a great combination of wines to enjoy at the part where we sit there and we read through the Agadah and we really go through everything we need. And those are the wines that are our choice on the table.
Okay, now for my next question. I have attended the tastings with you where you presented the Tabor wines with various cheeses. I've heard you speak at the time that the current trend is to do it with chocolate.
Right.
Now, before we get into the differences of what cheese does to the taste of the wine as opposed to what chocolate does to the taste of the wine, while you think about that, my next question to you is, let's talk a little bit about the terroir. You guys have four different types of soil where your wines grow. Now, are you trying to tell me that, for example, a Cabernet grape would taste different depending on the type of soil?
Well, first of all, yes. I mean, one of the things that the winemaker Ali Initial tried to look into when he started working at the winery was what is the impact of the soil on the wine. Now, it's not a sole impact. It's not that soil on its own impacts the grapes. It's always a combination, you know, of everything that helps a grape become a great grape, whether it's the water or whether it's the sun. And in Israel, you know, Tabor vineyards are in great areas. And the process in that Dama line is that they're all 12 months oaked in French and American oak. They are all picked in the same, you know, in the same time. But the process of picking and choosing and dividing the wines according to the type of soil does give very distinct different wines from one another. And you know, when you have a grape that grows on terra rossa soil, which is a very minerally red soil with a lot of iron, it is very different than growing a grape in a rocky soil, a rocky volcanic soil, because the whole the process of growing the roots of the plant and everything else will be essentially different. Even worldwide, when you have New Zealand wines that grow a lot on terra rossa soil, they're very distinctly different than other wines in other places. So the soil has an influence. The influence comes from that. The influence comes from the oak. The influence comes from the whole process. But you've tasted all the wines, and you see how you get two Cabernets from the same area in Israel that are so different from one another, or two Merlots. The chalk soil Merlot is immensely different from the volcanic soil Merlot. The nose is different. The taste is different. Even the body of the wines are different. The tannins are different. So, yes, we know that, you know, it's really important to decide where you're going to have your vineyards even before you start actually producing the wine.
Yeah. Now, let's go back to what I mentioned right before I asked this question about what differences does chocolate bring out in the wine as opposed to cheese, considering that for centuries cheese has been the traditional way of tasting wine with.
Right.
All of a sudden the difference? Where did this trend start?
I think that it starts, well, first of all, you know, every trend starts by people trying new things. Now, the fact that we've always cared wines with cheese doesn't mean that, you know, historically wine has to always be paired with cheese. I have to say that in the past you had very strict rules and regulation kind of rules about what you pair with what and what kind of fish you pair with which kind of wine. And usually I believe that if you enjoy a wine, you can pair it with any other dish you enjoy. It's just a matter of really what you like and what is tasty for you. With the chocolate, the first time that I started looking into pairing wine with chocolate, I actually, from trying it out, I found that chocolate brings out so many of the flavors and the aromas that we always talk about and we always look for when we drink wine. If you, for example, have a Merlot and you have, you know, a Merlot with a lot of berries and a lot of blackberries and you have to that a piece of chocolate that is either dark chocolate or it's even a fruit-based chocolate, it's almost like you have this amazing symphony in your mouth of getting every flavor that you enjoy in the wine, but just as a bigger experience. I mean, the fruit comes out immensely once you mix the chocolate and the wine. And there's a way to do it. You don't just eat chocolate and drink wine. You take a piece of chocolate, or you take a very nice chocolate dish, like a very rich chocolate dessert. You put it in your mouth, you leave it for a bit, and then you sip the wine through that chocolate or through that chocolate dish. And when you then swallow it, you really feel the impact and the difference between having the wine before the chocolate and having the wine after the chocolate. Cheese and wine go together because it's a nice combination. The cheese is not overpowering the wine. It really truly accompanies the wine. With the chocolate, I think it just brings out the flavors that you enjoy in the wine. So if you have the volcanic soil wine that has a very strong vanilla nose, and it has so much going on in the wine, it's such a rich wine, and you eat it with a nut-based chocolate or a milk chocolate, you really have a whole different kind of pleasure. I mean, it's just, when it comes to the taste and the experience, it's just very different. And what is nice, especially at the end of a very long evening with a lot of wine and a lot of food, to have, you know, a small glass of wine at the end there with the chocolate just comes and gives a total twist to the wine that you've been drinking the whole evening. It's a fun thing to do, and it's definitely a tasty thing to do. So I always recommend it.
Okay. In other words, if you were to do a tasting today, you would prefer to do it with cheese or with chocolate?
What I usually do in tastings is that during the tasting, we have like refreshments. And those refreshments would always be, not always, but they usually they're based on fruit and they're based on cheese. And the idea also is to let you drink, you know, 3-4 different types of wine. Then you almost clean your palate and make it once again neutral with cheese and fruit, and when you go back to drinking additional wines, you can actually start tasting all the flavors over again. In most of the tasting that I've done, the people who come to taste the wines are not don't come to taste it in order to spit the wine out. They come to taste it in order to drink, you know, the amount of wine that they get and enjoy it. So you do need this stop, you know, after 4 or 5 bottles of wine, clean your palate, get this fruity flavors from the fruit and from the cheese, and then when you go back into the wines, you dive back into the rich world of the flavors and the aromas, you know, the nose, everything. At the end of the tasting, I always tell people, you know, go back to the one of the soil series wines that you enjoyed the most with a piece of chocolate. If you're a dark chocolate kind of person, then you pick a really nice piece of dark chocolate. And if you're a white chocolate kind of person, pick that or milk chocolate. Always pick a chocolate that you like. And then let it melt in your mouth. And before you swallow the chocolate, drink your wine again. And I have yet to find a person who does this and doesn't say, wow, it tastes so different. And usually the wow comes from, you know, everything I tasted before is here, but so much stronger. So the effect of the chocolate at the end, it's also, you know, you end the evening with a dessert because you want to end it on a sweet note. The same thing when you drink wine, you know, end with my wine also on a sweet note. Instead of choosing a dessert wine that is sweet, then end it with a piece of chocolate that you enjoy. The combination is just so great and so much fun.
I hear. Well, thank you very, very much for calling in. As always, it is a pleasure and an education talking to you. And do let me know next time you have another Tabor tasting. I would absolutely love to attend.
First of all, I'd be
happy
to. Thank you
very much.
So Boris doing so many great things, and it would be fun to have you back to another tasting. And Chag Sameach to everyone.
Chag Kasher V'Sameach. Good night. Bye. And if you have any questions, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any comments, please call us in at 714-333-3357. Meanwhile, while we're waiting for our next guest, let us bring up another subject. The subject is 4 cups of wine. On every other holiday, we just make Kiddush, and that's it, unless we go to have some wine during the meal. But there is no requirement other than making of the Kiddush. Here, all of a sudden, we drink 4 cups. Not only is it because it's something that we like to do, but basically because the sages instituted it, and even though it is not directly mentioned in the Torah, in the 5 books of Moses, it is something that we are very stringent about. In fact, it says that a poor person who depends on the public dole for his livelihood, for example, must be provided with wine for the Arba Kosot. The Code of Jewish Law, the Shulchan Aruch, rules that an indigent person should even sell his clothes, borrow money, or hire himself out as a laborer in order to obtain funds to purchase the wine. Question is, okay, 4 cups? Why 4 cups? That still doesn't answer, why the 4 cups? Okay, we have to do it. Fine. And there are various opinions, including one that says that the 4 cups correspond to the 4 expressions of redemption started towards the beginning of Parshas Vayera, where it says, I shall take you out, I shall redeem you, I shall take you to me. So it's in Shmois. I apologize, not Bereishis, my mistake. And basically, those 4 expressions which explain to us about what is about to come, that we will be redeemed, that we will be saved, that we will be taken out, that we will be accepted by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Almighty Himself, those are the reasons, one of the reasons given, of why we should have 4 cups of wine. Other reasons for a cup of wine, which is also given, is when Pharaoh's butler, who was incarcerated together with Joseph, when he mentions trouble he got with the cup, he mentions the cup 4 times. Now, what does some Egyptians' transgression with a cup of wine have to do with us drinking 4 wines on Passover? The fact is, had the butler not related his dream, had he not mentioned the cup, there would have been no start to the actual moment of redemption. The actual moment of redemption started way, way before there was even a case of slavery. There was even a need for redemption. Because the Kodesh Baruch Hu, as we are always taught, provides the remedy long before he brings what we may consider a problem. In the meantime, if you have any questions, any comments, please give us a call at 714-333-3357. That's 714-333-3357. While we wait, we will also play an interview that I made taped last Wednesday At the end of our show at Gotham Wine and Liquor's 8th Annual Wine Extravaganza. It was done with the representative of Tishby Wines in the United States, Yoav Sisley. There was a lot of noise.
Yoav, the distributor of Tishby. Tell us a little bit about the wine that you would recommend for the Arbach of Sot and wine that you would recommend in the main itself.
I think one of the wines that might do very well in the Arbach Osot will be the Tishbi Cabernet Petit Syrah, which is a blend of Cabernet Sauvignon and Petit Syrah. The wine doesn't see any oak, so it's light enough so you can drink four glasses and probably still be able to finish the meal. So that's everything, one of the wines for the people who like the red wine. On the white side, if someone likes dry but a little fruit at the end, I would go with the Emerald Riesling, which is not a sweet wine. It's a dry with a hint of sweetness at the end.
Right.
Which makes it very appealable for people who like, you know, the fruitiness or the sweetness or something that, but don't want to buy or don't want to drink the Moscat or the very sweet wine that's basically very high in alcohol in there. So this is two wines I would suggest for red and white. Sorry, we have one more wine. We just brought in a new wine that came in 2 weeks ago, the Shiraz from the vineyard, from Tishbi Estate, from Tishbi. And this wine also has a Shiraz characteristic, but has a little more fruit to it, so it makes it very appealing also for the four glasses, the Arbach Osot. Now,
what is the price range?
The price range is about $12 to $14.
Very reasonable.
So it's within the reach. Then if you want something that it's a little more, a little heavier, but still light, still soft, you might want to try the Tishbi Pinot Noir, which we're bringing from Gush Etzion, the grapes are from Gush Etzion, from the vineyard in Gush Etzion, and it's not heavy as the Oregon Pinot Noir, it's not as light as the Burgundy, somewhere in between, so it has, I guess, the best of both worlds. So you can really enjoy the substance, the depth, but it's really very soft, so you can really enjoy drinking it. That's one wine. Another one, if you like something very heavy, something that has a lot of tan, there are two.
Well, let's say, for example, during the meal, I'm enjoying a brisket, which is a heavy beef. What would I pair it with?
I would go with the Special Reserve, which is one of my favorites. It's a Bordeaux blend coming from Zeboker, from the desert. And it is a blend of Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc and Merlot. The wine is big but very soft, so it can really live up to the meat and the sauce and everything. So that's something I will go for. If you want something to just be only Cabernet Sauvignon, if you don't like the blend, which is a little softer, go with the Tishbi Estate Cabernet Sauvignon, which is it's awesome. It's a seed oak, but again, it's one thing I found out, many of the wines from Tishbi are very soft, so they are very approachable.
Yes. And the Tishbi line goes from where to where price-wise? What is the price range?
We go from $10 to $80.
What do you have in the higher end?
You want to go from the 80 down? Okay, let's start with the 80.
Let's start with the 80.
When I say 80, it's approximately, because as you know, different places sell differently. But we just brought in a wine which is very limited. We have about 20 cases of 6 bottles, so it's only 120 bottles here in the U.S. It's a Barbera Zinfandel.
Ah,
it's a blend of 50%, 50%.
No?
It's fortified, so it's sweet. But it sees 18 months in oak, so it has It has the combination of the sweetness and the dryness. It's amazing wine. This is something very, very limited and done with very. We brought, as I said, we have about 120 bottles here in the U.S. So this is the $80. Then you go down. You go to the special reserve I mentioned. Ah, if you like white, we have the Tishbe Estate White, which is awesome. And then if you would like something that has a little more dryness to it, you go with Special Reserve, the 2007 Special Reserve, or the Estate 09. And this is a Chardonnay.
Mm-hmm.
And just the way they make it, and they give it, since it's the reserve is in oak, so you have a little more dryness to it. It's a little more robust, and again, it depends what you drink, what you eat.
Now let me play devil's advocate for a minute, okay?
No, don't do that. I like the easy one. Yes.
One of my favorite Israeli wines is one of your competitors. What do you have to compare it? And I'm talking about not a cheap wine, I'm talking about an expensive wine. I'm talking about Amara by Beniamina. The case. What do you have comparable? And not just comparable in price, but comparable in the touch.
Israel happens to be a place where a lot of great wines coming out of there.
Absolutely.
As I said before when we talked, I grew up with one winery. Now we have over 200 wineries. And many of the great wines you find in great restaurants here in New York. I would go with a Special Reserve. That's the way I go with it, for the level, this level. So that's where I put either the Cabernet Sauvignon from Fayouval or the blend that we mentioned before. Would go very well. Depends which one of their wines, but I can't say equivalent, because each one of them has their own characteristics, and each one of them you might like in different time, different place, and different people.
Yes. Okay. Thank you
very
much.
It's all in the mind.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, one of the things I always said about wine critics is just because Robert Parker likes it does not necessarily mean I'm going to like it or I'm going to like it as much as he does.
Let me suggest an exercise in drinking wine, and take the same bottle of wine and try it three different times. One when you're really angry with someone. Try one when you're in love with someone, and try one when you're very just sitting on the beach and just relaxing. You see
what, when I first met Costa, he served me a glass of a wine from Cyprus. Number one. So he poured it and he said, "Taste it now." He says, "Now wait." Half an hour later, he told me, "Taste it again." 2 hours later, he told me, "Taste it again." I would have sworn there were three different bottles, except that I saw it in front of me, the same bottle. I poured it.
It is another phenomenon, which is like the Special Reserve I mentioned to you.
Mm-hmm.
If you drink it throughout the meal, you see how it changes.
Absolutely, as it is.
So it's two things. Either one, the wine changes throughout the meal. Two, if you take the same wine in different situations, where the mind is working on the wine as well.
Right.
That's the exercise I did before with people and things. Also, when you taste wine, close your eyes. Let your mind, let your palate, let your nose work. Not your eyes necessarily.
Okay, Johan, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much.
Give me your card, yeah. I'll send you an email with a link where you can listen to it from the archive.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can't hear it anymore.
Good luck with that. Great with you.
Thank you.
Hey, do we have someone on the line? Hello? Seem to be a technical difficulty. We have someone on the line. Hello? Are you there? Hello? person just hung up. Please call back. Hopefully that person will call us back. There seems to be a problem. Anyway, if you have any questions, please give us a call at 714-333-3357. That's 714-333-3357. We have someone on the line right now. Hello, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Good.
How are you this evening?
I'm good. How are you?
Okay. And we have with us Noah. Noah Kamen, who will talk to us about the various wine selections that his company distributes and the price ranges. Let's start with the first question as to what would be your recommendation for the four cups of wine, bearing in mind that, first, you don't want a wine that is very heavy. Second, you don't want a wine that is too dry, nor do you want something that is overly sweet. What would you start by recommending?
Right, so this is always the tricky question, because everybody likes something a little bit different.
Of course.
For myself, I always do a glass of something different for each of my four different cups. You know, so I always buy a large variety of wine for my family Seders. And, you know, I enjoy, you know, a different glass each time. But other people like to, you know, buy a lot of one item and then a few bottles of something else to enjoy with dinner. So, you know, it's always a tricky question. You know, if you want something that's, you know, like you said, you know, not too heavy, not too light, not too sweet, not too dry. You know, from my portfolio, we have a couple of excellent choices. The Dolce Mente, Gabriel Dolce Mente Red and White.
Yes, as a matter of fact, that's what I intend to use for the four cups.
Good. Good. I think I have some on my list for this year as well. They're semi, you know, the red is a semi-dry and the white is a semi-sweet. They're both blends. You know, they're nice, they're soft, they're smooth, they're fruity, not too sweet and not too dry, and, you know, very easy to have four glasses of them. You know, but, you know, you can also always do something, you know, fuller bodied or drier, you know, if that's your if that's your personal choice.
Right. Now,
you know,
as we get into the meat itself,
mm-hmm.
What wines would you recommend?
So for the meal itself, you know, most families do, you know, a brisket, or they do a standing rib roast, or they do a pot roast. You know,
mm-hmm.
they do something like,
right.
you know, along those lines. They do a fairly heavy, fairly rich, you know, main course. And, you know, basically the guidelines to follow when picking wine to go with, you know, a meal, any meal, whether it's, you know, a Passover Seder or, you know, just, you know, Shabbos dinner or just some random Tuesday night. The fuller and richer and heartier the meal, the fuller and richer and heartier the wine you want to go along with it. So, you know, if you're doing a brisket or a pot roast or something along those lines, I would recommend, you know, a full-bodied Cabernet Sauvignon or a Syrah or even a Zinfandel.
What are some of the lines that you would recommend? Give us, aside from the type of wine, tell us what wines you would recommend.
Absolutely. So a couple of very good Cabernets on the market. There's the Ella Valley Vineyard, grown in the Judean Hills in the Ella Valley. It's basically, in my opinion, the perfect cross between New World style and Old World style. So it has the full-bodied bodiness that people look for from, you know, a wine, say, from California or from Chile. But it's not, you know, so quite as fruity, and it's not as tannic. It's a little softer than that. And its flavors taste more like something you would expect to get from France. So I think it's a really, really good kind of melding of the two different styles. Another cab in my portfolio is the Chevron Heights, you know, Reserve Cab.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a little more New World style. It's a little more California style. fruitier, a little bit, you know, bigger in body and richer. You know, both very good wines, just different styles.
And they
cost about the same.
Right. I remember once at the tasting, I had one of your wines that had a very interesting smoky taste to it. I believe it was
that,
one of the Gideon. Yes, the Gideon's Jerusalem Hills. I believe it was.
Well, there's the Jerusalem Hills and there's the Gideon. They're both grown in the,
right,
in the
right.
Judean Heights, in the Judean Hills. And actually, the wineries are affiliated with each other. But we have one line called the Jerusalem Hills, and we have one line called Gideon. Both are very good wines. Both and both have, you know, something, you know, kind of different and special to them. And I think it's kind of, I'm starting to describe it as the terroir of the Judean Hills and the Jerusalem Hills area. You know, because of, you know, the soil and because of the types of trees and things like that that are in the area, you get in the wines that are grown there a lot of kind of that smokiness, like a smoked pine almost,
mm-hmm.
both aroma and sometimes flavor as well, and also sometimes some iodine. And these aren't bad qualities in the wine. It's you know, some people taste it, they don't like that aspect of it. And they you know, some people ask me, is this wine bad? And the answer is no, of course it's not bad. Although you do get bad wine sometimes. It's the terroir of the region. You know, I'm kind of looking forward to the day when they make that, you know, when they make the Judean Hills its own, you know, recognized region, its own DOC, you know, the way Burgundy is or Bordeaux.
Right.
You know? So,
I find interesting about, the first time I tasted that smokiness, at first it felt strange. As I was savoring it further, it became very, very interesting. Actually, I happen to like that smokiness occasionally. No, I could not drink that wine all the time. But then again, nobody who really knows wines would drink the same wine over and over and over. Each
exactly.
wine has its own occasion. Each wine goes with its own particular moment, its own type of food. But I
mm-hmm.
think that smokiness is a very interesting wine, and it enhances certain types of heavier meats. It goes
oh,
with it very, very well. It's a superb pairing.
Absolutely. You know, this wouldn't, you know, the idea that, you know, one of the things I usually recommend to have a wine like that with is a little tricky for, you know, Ashkenazi Jews and some Sephardi Jews as well at Passover, but it's, you know, things like mushroom barley soup. You know, you've got a rich, hearty, earthy food in its own right, you know, that you're pairing with a rich, hearty, earthy, smoky wine. And the flavors meld very nicely, and they play off each other very nicely, and they complement each other very nicely. So you're exactly right, exactly right. So, you know, you can try a wine and not like it, and then you try it again 6 months later in a different circumstance, and you say, oh, I didn't used to like this wine, but I like it now, and then have it 6 months later and not like it that third time because of, again, the circumstances. And it's all about the framework in which you put a wine.
Well,
you know?
Not only that, it's also how long it stayed open. I remember the first time I spoke to Kostas last year. You were there, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And he served me a bottle of Lamburi, which
mm-hmm.
I poured, and he said, taste it now. I tasted it, and it wasn't bad, but something wasn't quite there. He says, now you're going to see what's going to happen. Wait half an hour. We waited half an hour. I tasted it again, just like I explained to Yoav Sisley from Tishbi, who was on before you. I tasted it again, and it was a different wine. An hour and a half later, I tasted it again, and it was completely different.
I agree with you.
So wine changes not only according to the 6 months, as you said, but even during the same meal, it'll change as it aerates.
Absolutely, and it's always interesting. And it's always interesting, you know, to experience that. And that's something important to remember that, you know, if you taste a wine at a tasting, you know, in a store or at a friend's house, always ask, how long has that wine been open? That way you know, okay, this is what the wine tastes like after 2 hours, or this is what the wine tastes like after 5 minutes, Because when you if you buy a bottle of it and you go home and you try it some other night, it might taste differently. And this way you know, mm-hmm. okay, it tastes a little differently because I haven't let it breathe enough or you know, things like that. Also, but I mean, also, of course, what you're eating it with and even whether, you know, how recently you brushed your teeth and things like that and how much, you know, salt you've eaten right. in the last 2 days, of course, can affect the way a wine tastes as well. But that's, you know, getting into the that's getting into the very nitty gritty, you know, and in some sense, very interesting aspect of wine. So,
mm-hmm.
but I actually had a very similar experience myself with the Lambori. The first time I tasted it, I didn't like it at all. And, you know, as you said, I was working for Costas at the time, and I told him, you know, I went back into work, you know, the next day, and I told him that I didn't like it at all. And he asked me why, and I explained it to him. I forget the exact reasons at this point. This is, you know, 2 years ago, why I didn't like it. And he basically told me to, he asked if I still had the bottle, and I said yes. He said, you know, did you reseal it and whatnot? I said, yeah, of course. And he said, well, when you go home tonight, try it again. Take the cork out, leave it out for about a half hour, and try it again. And I did. And it was a very beautiful, lovely, delicious wine. And as you said, you just it's all about how you experience it and the framework in which you experience it that, you know, can really affect how much you enjoy it, you know. And even, you know, whether you're out with friends or have a whole bunch of friends over and you're having a very good time can make, you know, what really is a mediocre wine taste that much better. You know, because your experience
absolutely.
Is better. You know, so it's the quality of the wine is important, but it's also the quality of the company is just as, or can be just as important. So always remember that. If you're having people over, you know, if you're having friends over for a party, you don't have to stress yourself out and, you know, run out and buy, you know, $80 bottles of wine. You know, you can go out and you can spend $15, $20 and get a very nice bottle and have
absolutely
just
there.
A better,
wine.
And have just as good, if not a better experience, you know, with the less expensive
mm-hmm.
wine, with the right people,
right.
you know?
Absolutely. Besides, when you buy an expensive wine, your expectations are much, much bigger.
Absolutely.
And sometimes
absolutely.
It may disappoint.
Mm-hmm. There's an important thing to remember is there are just as many, percentage-wise, bad wines that cost $50 and more as there are bad wines that cost less than $50. You're just as likely to find a bad wine by spending a lot of money as you are to find a bad wine by spending very little. You know, price is no longer an indicator of how good a wine is. You know, I have some wine in my portfolio, some Argentine wine.
Hold on one second. Hello, Noah, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, I don't know what happened. We seem to lose the... Anyway, I apologize for that.
That's okay.
Technical problem with the switchboard, I guess. Okay, anyway, how would you pair some of the wines you represent with some of the typical meals at the Seder.
Okay.
And we have exactly 30 seconds. We will be talking to our next guest in 30 seconds.
Okay. So, you know, the like I said, there's those two cabs, the Ella Valley and the Jerusalem Heights. There's also, you know, those are the two cabs. There's Syrah. Both companies make a Syrah, which is excellent, again, for, you know, the main course. The Dolce Mente that we were talking about for the four cups also would go, you know, would go fine with dessert. But you can also do, Cantina Gabrielle also makes a Moscato, which is a delicious Moscato, very classic Italian Moscato. Would go very nicely with dessert. You know, things like the filter fish and, you know, matzo ball soup and whatnot, those can be tricky to pair a wine with. I would honestly, whatever your heart tells you, you know, if you feel like having, you know, a red, have a red. If you feel like having a white, have a white. I would recommend something a little on the lighter side, though. I wouldn't go with anything too heavy because those are delicate flavors. So,
okay.
You know, and if your family doesn't eat a lot of red meat like mine does, and you do turkey, you know, Pinot Noir.
No, we are carnivores to the core. Yeah. I mean, we are into red meat. Hardcore carnivores.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, Noah, it's been a pleasure talking to you, as always.
Absolutely.
And let's do it again soon.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Have
and
a good
night,
Pesach.
Noah.
Good night.
Gittin Pesach. A kosher Pesach.
Thank you. Okay.
And
thank
we're
you.
Now ready for our next guest. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. And let's talk a little bit about J-Deal.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for having us on the show.
What?
I said thank you so much for having us on the show.
It's a pleasure. We try to bring in guests who actually are doing something for the community, and I think J-Deal is a superb idea whose time has come. So explain a little bit about J-Deal.
So we can't take credit for the idea. We're following really what's a very successful model in the secular world, sites like Groupon and Living Social. What we're doing that's different is that we've applied that very successful business model to the Jewish niche.
Right. In fact, if you recall at last week's Gotham Wine and Liquors 8th Wine Extravaganza, 8th Annual Wine Extravaganza, we interviewed a couple who sounded almost like a living commercial for J-Deal. They were very, very enthusiastic about J-Deal. Yes, they had tried the other groups that you just mentioned, the Groupon and the Living Social. But as they said, occasionally they will find something that they can use. But as Jews, they almost every day find something on J-Deal.
And I think that's really,
In fact, that particular show, at the door was $35. These people came in with a J-Deal coupon for $18. Today, for example, on email, I got one where you were offering half price at Basel for food and wine.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, wine is great.
Right. Basel is a great little restaurant.
Absolutely. First, it's great to have customers of J-Deal that are so happy, and it's gratifying to hear that kind of feedback. And fortunately, we get that quite often. You know, we're really offering deals that speak to the Jewish community. So, anything food related, for instance, is of course kosher. And you know, on Groupon or Living Social, you know, you would find those kinds of deals. But we're not only offering products and services. One of the nice things about the platform that we've been able to do is really to use it as a means to even raise money for Jewish not-for-profits. So, for instance, we had a very successful campaign recently for Mayor Panim, where we raised almost $20,000 towards feeding the hungry in Israel. Likewise, we had a very successful campaign recently with the One Family Fund, where we raised about $11,000. So taking the same concept and allowing the community to use it as a forum to raise money has likewise been very, very gratifying.
Absolutely, it is a great idea. Not only can you raise money that way, but you also save money to the average person, the winning combination.
Absolutely. So on, you know, on our standard deals, we're offering everything from you know, unique kosher restaurants, Jewish-related shows, products or services that speak to the Jewish community, and we're also featuring Jewish merchants, those merchants that want exposure within the Jewish community.
Mm-hmm. How do you go around finding all these places?
It's a combination of direct
contact. And I'm not asking for any of your business secrets.
No,
okay.
No problem.
You misunderstand the question.
No, it's a combination of direct sales, but also, you know, the word has really spread on JDeal and how valuable a tool this is for merchants to really do two things. One, it's been proven to be very effective in driving new customers, but two, also in getting tremendous brand exposure on the day that we're running the promotion for the merchant. So with that knowledge and that with that exposure, you know, many merchants are contacting us directly. And on the website, we have a number of different tools that they can enter their information in that sends it then to the sales team, and the sales team contacts them about running an offer.
Okay, so let me ask you a question. So today's mail, I get an offer, okay? I do not have a particular need today, but probably will need it next week. So what do I do?
So the offers are normally expiring over a period of time, and it can be anywhere from a month to 12 months, depending on the desire of the merchant. So today, for instance, we're running admission tickets half price to the Jewish Museum, and that
right.
has an expiration of several months. So you have a period of time to buy it with the anticipation of using it in the future.
When you say a period of time to buy it, instead of buying it today, can I buy it next week when I intend to go there, or do I have to buy it today but I can use it next week?
That's the nature of the daily deal, is that you have to take advantage of it on the day that the deal is offered. And once that deal expires, then unfortunately you can't buy it. So there
right.
is some and that's why the model works so well. There's urgency to take advantage of the offer while it's live.
Okay. Do you have any other great offers that are going to be coming in the near future? So far, everything I've seen has been a winner.
We have a lot of exciting offers, and you know, one of the fun things about this business. That you can be very creative in the kinds of offers that you make, but no, there's many, many exciting things coming in the pipeline.
Excellent. How long have you been doing this?
Well, the company that owns JDeal is called J Media Connections, and we have been around for over 2 years. Actually, the first property that we launched is a site called MetroEma, which is a social networking site for Jewish moms. And JDeal, we launched just in November, towards the end of November.
And did you run something similar before this, or this is the first such deal?
Well, the first property was MetroEma. Again, that started about 2 years ago.
Right.
And the second property that we've now launched is JDeal. And you know, since launching, we've now featured well over 100 merchants on the site.
Excellent. And hopefully some of those merchants will also be back in the future, not just for your sake, but also for their own sake, as so many people are actually taking advantage of these things.
Yeah. We're now at the point where we're rerunning merchants, and we have many that have are on the waiting list and very anxious to get back on. And also our database has grown substantially since we've launched, and continues to grow on a weekly basis. It's the word has really spread, not just in the New York area, but we're now expanding across the U.S. and overseas as well.
Excellent. Okay, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Alan.
Really,
good
my
luck.
Pleasure. And thank you again
and
so much for having us.
May the company grow stronger and stronger with
thank
better
you very,
and better
very
ideas.
Much. Thank you. And stay tuned for many exciting deals.
I absolutely intend to.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
In the next few minutes, we will be talking to Chef Jeff Nathan from Abigail's on Broadway. That will be the highlight of our show. In the meantime, if you have any questions, if you have any comments, if there is anything you want to request for our next show or you want to comment about the guests that we just had, please call us at 714-333-3357. That's 714-333-3357. By the way, all the wines that we have been discussing and many, many more, you can get at Gotham Wines and Liquor in Manhattan. They have a selection of over 300 kosher wines and spirits. Most of them kosher for Passover. In fact, we met most of our guests today and many others at Gotham Wines and Liquor's 8th annual wine extravaganza, which was held last Wednesday at the West End Institutional Synagogue on 120 West 76 in Manhattan. Meanwhile, if you have any questions, please give us a call at 714-333-3357. In about 4 minutes, we will hear from Chef Jeff Nathan from Abigail's on Broadway, author of 2 cookbooks, Adventures in Jewish Cooking, and Jeff Nathan's Family Suppers. He also happens to be a television personality with his own show on Jewish cooking on public television. The show is called New Jewish Cooking. He will explain to us what is meant by New Jewish Cooking. We will talk about his restaurant, how he evolved as a restaurateur, how he became interested in the food business at a very, very young age. And it promises to be a very exciting show. We will also discuss Passover recipes and so on. Please stay tuned. Our guest will be on in 3 minutes. Meanwhile, if you have any questions, if you have any comments, give us a call on 714-333-3357. That's 714-333-3357. Remember, that's 714-333-3357. Now, next week, due to Passover, we will not have a show. But the week after, we will be talking to the editor, the food editor of Bina Magazine, a former restaurateur of a dairy restaurant in New Jersey, and the author of 2 cookbooks, The Daily Gourmet and The At-Home Gourmet. We'll be talking to Sarah Lasry. I am looking at her books. The recipes are easy, very interesting, and the photography is superb. Meanwhile, our guest has just called in. We'll speak to him right now. Good evening. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
This is Jeff Nathan.
Jeff Nathan, good evening, sir. How are you?
I'm okay.
It's a pleasure talking to you.
Same here.
Okay, we're now online. I have been to your restaurant many, many times, and every time I walk away, I feel that I have just witnessed a virtuoso performance. Just like the canvas and a paintbrush is to a painter, just like a violin is to somebody of the caliber of an Isaac Stern, the cooking utensils are to you, Chef Nathan. Explain to us, what makes you tick? What is the driving force to constantly keep on improving and coming up with new ideas?
I truly think that passion is the number one key. I think you have to really enjoy what you're doing. I think you have to have a love for cooking and the business in general. I don't think of it as a job. I never have, ever since I'm a young boy. Even the basic reading materials that I read when I'm home to relax always have something to do with the business itself. So I think you just need to love what you do. It's like I told my son, when you thinking about a career, don't think about the money aspect of it. Make sure that it's something that you really love to do, because when you wake up every morning and you're going to work and you enjoy what you do, it makes all the difference in the world.
Absolutely. You live healthier, you live longer, and you enjoy life.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now,
so that
what point did you realize that you're interested in food, not just eating it, but actually, you know, making it?
I remember as a boy when the babysitter came over and watched us. My sister would stay watching television, and I would go in the kitchen and make these little hors d'oeuvres. I used to take crackers and put cream cheese on it, carve out little decorations and olives, and put them on the crackers until my parents came home. And when they came home, they were all soggy, and you couldn't really eat them. But the whole point was, is I always had that interest. I wanted to cook breakfast. I never forget during the high holidays at my grandma's, all the men would be sitting and watching television, or they would be sitting in the living room and davening. And meanwhile, I would be in the kitchen with the women making crepe and gefilte fish and chicken liver. And so, you know, it's something that I always wanted to do. I find, you know, the creative part of it is something I love. Culinary school was great. You know, it gives you the basics, culinary school. I think it's very important. But, you know, you can go to school and you can come out. If it's not in your blood and you don't have a passion for it, you can go to school for the rest of your life. It's going to do nothing. So it's important, again, that you love what you do. And then, you know what, you can always tell if you're good at something also. There's no need to do something and continue to do it and see your peers are doing better than you when you're, like, struggling with it. You have to be honest to yourself and say, you know what, I don't think this is for me. And, you know, people need to do that, I think, in everything, whether you're going to school to be a doctor or an attorney. And, you know, some people find it more difficult. They find it more work. And once that word work is there and it's too much like work, if you could find that out at a young age, then that's something to think about way ahead of. You'd be ahead of the game if you think about that in the beginning and then just try to find something that you're really more into.
Now, at what point in your life did you decide, okay, this is it. I am, of all the possible professions that are open, the one I'm going to go into is being a chef?
Well, honestly, at 15 years old, I was a dishwasher in a restaurant, and then I was moved up to a salad person. At 17, I went into the Navy for 4 years. I was involved with cooking with the Sixth Fleet, with Menachem Begin and Sadat during the Carter administration. We were in Israel. So, I mean, I would say ever since, I mean, after my bar mitzvah, I think there was a calling.
Now, after the Navy, I believe you went to the Culinary Institute of America, the CIA, America's
exactly.
foremost school.
Exactly. The Navy paid the, I mean, when I went to the Navy, it was lucky. It wasn't wartime, so I had a lot of schooling. I traveled the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think I ate all over the world also. And the Navy paid the GI Bill, so it paid my college education. And I went
wow.
to the Culinary Institute of America. And from there, after that, I think I worked about a year and a half for free. And I worked with a lot of famous chefs throughout New York and abroad, just trying to gain and learn more experience. And then eventually I went back to college and went to Rutgers and was working on my degree for food science, very involved now with recipe development, making foods for putting on the shelves for Whole Foods or Trader Joe's or Hain Celestial. I work with culinary development for Hain Celestial and work on a lot of the different products, whether it's snacks or different types of soups and sauces. So very diverse, very diverse.
Now, tell us about how you came into Abigail's. From what I understand, you originally you did not intend to keep this as a restaurant forever.
Exactly.
How did that happen?
I'll try to give you the short version. If it gets too long, you got to tell me.
Okay.
I used to buy and sell restaurants, and one day my broker, whose name was Bob Ross, he's an Orthodox gentleman, he knew I sold my Italian restaurant, and he knew I was ready to look for another restaurant, so he told me he had one on 35th and Madison. So I said, wow, that rent has got to be so expensive. But he said it's Chapter 11. So I looked at it, and I personally thought it was being run terribly. And if it's being run terribly, that gives me a lot of room for improvement. If it was running good, I'd walk away, because who am I? What am I going to – if it looks like it's good and it's not running good, then there's another reason beyond my capabilities. So I ended up taking it over, and I changed a lot of things. And my whole concept back then, you know, many years ago was – I know, after speaking to a lot of Orthodox Jews, and I had a lot of conversations with the Mashkiyim, and just in general, just asking. I love to ask people and get as many comments as I can. They weren't looking for a kosher restaurant that serves kosher food. Let me rephrase that. Kosher-style food. They weren't looking for the briskets and the chicken soups and the chopped livers, and number one, that's not my forte anyway. And you have a lot of basic delis that do that and do that very well. They wanted something.
That may not be your forte. However, I have seen your recipes in your cookbooks. I have tried your recipes in your cookbooks.
Thank you.
They are superb.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you. So I just tried, basically, I said, let me open up a modern American restaurant that just happens to be kosher. And there's no Jewish items on the menu, and it's all kosher. And to me, the thrill that I get is every time a table calls me out and they look first at me sort of sternly, it gets me upset. I figured maybe they didn't like something, I overcooked the steak, or whatever it may be. Instead, they said, this can't be kosher. I mean, I love that. I mean, you can't get a better compliment than that. And, you know, listen, this was a long time ago. There's a lot of other restaurants doing the same thing now, but I feel pretty good that in the very beginning I was a pioneer at this, and I was very involved also with getting more ingredients kosher. I think Menachem Lubinsky is, to me, the forerunner in that with Kosher Fest every year. He was the one behind it. And basically, I think all the big companies got a chance to see that the kosher consumer is educated, are willing to try new and interesting foods, and not interested in just pastrami and chopped liver. So basically, Menachem got all these big companies involved together and started getting involved with Kosher Fest, and it started growing and growing and growing, and every year it outdoes the year before. And, you know, 20 years ago, whoever heard of sushi or rice wine vinegar or wasabi or all these different types of Asian sauces that we have? I mean, our painter's palette now is large. When I first started, I was working with three or four colors. Yes, you can paint a beautiful picture with three or four colors, but there's nothing like using 10 to 15 colors. It's going to look at
That's
you.
True.
It's going to jump at you. It's going to have definition. It's going to have nuances with it, and that's what's happened. So today, I think our painter's palette with the ingredients that we're able to use in kosher cooking rivals any restaurant in the non-kosher world.
Well, as a matter of fact, one thing I always liked about your restaurant, and I even remarked about it when I reviewed your restaurant the first time last year, was the decor is different. It's stepping out of present-day New York with all the hustle and bustle and just going into a different era. As I walk downstairs into your restaurant, it reminds me of the great majestic restaurants that appeared in the movies of the 30s and the 40s.
That's interesting. That's very interesting.
Also, when I remember when I looked at the different rooms besides your main dining room.
Right.
Small library area, another area that's considerably bigger, and so on. I mean, there is something about your restaurant between the aromas from the food as during meal times, between the ambience and the music that is so softly piped in, there is something very welcoming, very warm about your restaurant. And as I speak to you, I see that it is an exact reflection of who you are. It shows your passion, it shows your interest, your attention to detail, not just in the food that you present, but in the whole presentation, everything about you.
Thank you.
It shows you as a very warm human being.
I appreciate that. I feel hospitality is very important. When a customer comes in, we don't know if they're in a bad mood or not, and we're here to try to
right.
change that mood or keep them in a good mood. And I'll tell you the truth, Chaim, there's a lot of restaurants out there today. They don't have to come to me. They can come anywhere.
That's correct.
I'm not doing them a favor. I need them. I need to keep them happy, and I have to try to do every step possible. Hospitality really is important. It means something. Hospitality doesn't mean just a waiter taking their order or a coat check hanging up their coat or a host saying, sit here or whatever. Hospitality goes beyond that because that is what's expected. Someone's coming in and they're paying for a meal. They expect the food to be good, and they expect the service to be good. That's just something that's normal. Hospitality is over and above that. It's making a person feel welcome and warm. If there's a problem, handling the problem at the table, not making anyone feel awkward at the table, not saying the word no. There's ways to say no without ever saying the word no. You know, so it's how you handle your guests from the second they are greeted, whether it's on the phone, or to how they're seated and how the menu is presented in front of them. The way the food comes out, I like to have a lot of wow effects, whether something sizzling or oversized items, sparklers on dishes. You know, the more time somebody can say, wow, I know that they're going to come back. And I want them to come back for not just the food and not just the service. It's an entire experience. And it's like wearing a suit. You can have a beautiful suit on, but if you have the wrong tie, you're going to notice that right away. Or if you have a pair of sneakers on with that suit, you're going to say, you know what, it looks good, but there's something wrong here. That doesn't go. And there's a lot of variables. I have 33 full-time employees in my restaurant. And let me tell you, it's very, very difficult keeping everyone on track, keeping everybody motivated, keeping everybody passionate, continually going over the rules and regulations, the different things that come up each day, giving the waiters a chance to vent and explain to us what they think. I learn from everybody, and every day we talk to the waiters and waitresses and hostess, and we ask for their comments and opinions. And my guests, customers, when they come in, their server reports, they can fill things out, and they can tell us how they think we did. And then today, Chaim, with social media between Foursquare and Facebook and Yelp, there's another whole world out there. So there's a lot of people.
Because one thing goes wrong, and everybody will know about it.
Exactly.
That's what the industry is up against these days.
Right. So it's tough. It's a tough business. You have to love what you do, and you have to be on top of it every day. And you're never going to please everybody. You're never going to be. I can serve 300 steaks, and then one person tells me, it's fatty, I don't like it, and this, that. What do you do? What do you tell them? The best you could do is on your menu, you could have written down, this particular steak is very fatty. But if they call you over, you can't
right.
take your finger and point to the menu. Didn't you read that? You know, you can't.
Of course.
It's not hospitality. So there's a lot more involved in than cooking is what I'm trying to bring out.
Oh, absolutely. And another thing I like at your restaurant a lot is the presentation.
Thank you.
I, for one, I am not particularly a fish eater. I remember when I went to your restaurant, I saw the table next to me. I saw somebody had some sushi. And it looked darn good. I mean, that was beautiful. Okay, a little bit nervous, a little hesitatingly, I ordered some sushi, and it came. Not only were the colors beautiful, but somehow somebody must have sensed that I was a little bit nervous, because right next to it, you had this little fountain, this Asian-like fountain that was, you know, the water was dripping from it, somehow very, very calming. It did manage to calm my nerves. And, of course, the sushi was absolutely delicious.
Oh, you know what? That's funny, because I remember seeing your face, and you said, I don't like raw fish. I said, listen, no problem. I said, but listen, just take a bite and try it. And you did not want to, but I'm telling you, I commend you. You were very brave. You tried it anyway.
Yes, and it was superb. You are one of the guys who taught me how to eat fish. 60-some years I did not eat fish. My mother, may she rest in peace, she would make fish. I wouldn't touch it. She could never understand. What type of a Jewish kid are you? What are you, an anti-Semite? You don't eat fish. I never ate fish. But you taught me how to.
Good. Well, I'm glad. I'm glad I did.
Now, let's talk a little bit about your cookbooks. One of your cookbooks, the first one, the one that I actually reviewed in my blog today, The Adventures in Jewish Cooking.
Yes.
Was a companion to your television show.
Yes,
now,
it was.
Now, that was a very, very successful television show watched all over the world.
Right.
Basically, what you do there is, I believe you demonstrate various dishes. It's a cooking show, basically, right?
Exactly. It was a cooking adventures, right. New Jewish cuisine, we called it.
Right. Now, what made that, I'm sorry, what exactly motivated you and how did you choose the different dishes that you were going to demonstrate on that show?
I called it New Jewish Cuisine, and I didn't have 100% to do with it. The producers were very involved. So we wanted it to be new style Jewish food. We wanted some classics, contemporary, and put a little spin to it. So Jewish style with a twist. And that's pretty, you know, that was pretty much it. I mean, whether it was making a basic hummus and incorporating fava beans and extra virgin oil and rosemary into it, where you still had the concept of a hummus, but you added different flavor profiles to it. If I made matzo balls into small little baby dumplings and served it with fresh basil oil, called it a matzo dumpling, or, you know, I made gnocchi, and it was really shlishkas, and, you know, I just put a twist on different things. I made something even called a twisted knish. I don't know, just, you know, interesting, fun items that I enjoy cooking. You know, you got to remember when you – I'm not a hotel-type cook that if you're in the Marriott or Hilton Hotel, for instance, not picking on hotels because the food in hotels is wonderful. But if you're in a Hilton Hotel in Hawaii and you're in one in New York, and if you're in New York and you have a specific dish that you like, it's going to taste the same in Hawaii, or it's going to taste the same in Chicago or Los Angeles, because everything is standardized. I'm not a standardized kind of guy. I like creativity. I like being able to find out from the market or what produce is available today. It's springtime now. Which wild mushrooms are coming in? The wild ramps are here. Or in the winter when the rich, hearty stews are coming and the root vegetables. I like to be able to continually play, and that keeps my creative juices flowing where it's never the same. So if I have the same menu for 3-4 months at a time, I know I can do specials every single day and play. So, you know, it keeps you excited, and that's the same. I kept the TV show with that same premise.
Very good. Now, that first book, I believe, was a companion to that show that was basically recipes from the show, right?
Well, combination of both, yes.
Okay. Today, when I reviewed that book, I took the liberty to post one of the recipes, which sounded so intriguing that there is no question I'm making it on Passover, and that's the veal Milanese with the tomato salad and arugula.
Right, right. Nice dish. Very nice dish.
Yes, yes. Now, because it's the box, unfortunately, I have to wait till the last day, but my mouth, as I said in that review, already started salivating now, and we're not even at the beginning of Passover. Now, after that book, you wrote a second book, Jeff Nathan Cook's Family Dinners.
Right.
That
Jeff
one
Nathan's,
has become
right.
one of my most used cookbooks. Again, the recipes are easy, and they all taste great.
Thank you. I tried to do something. I think the first cookbook, Adventures in Jewish Cooking, was a little more foo-foo. It was a little more difficult, a little more, I'm not going to say difficult, it was a little more complicated. Jeff Nathan's Family Suppers is easier. I give a lot more tips
right.
on what to do with leftovers, making more than the right amount and freezing it, ways to do a lot of hints, making certain butters with herbs in them and rolling them up and leaving them in the refrigerator or the freezer. Just much more simplistic cooking. So when you come home at the end of the day, you can make a simple meal. And it was all the pictures are done in my home. The photography was done in my backyard, in my house. I made everything from the house. I went to the supermarket mm-hmm. and bought all the ingredients. So everything is pretty much exact. And it wasn't done like from restaurant cooking. It was done from home cooking. I actually enjoy that. There's a lot of recipes in there I love.
Now, let me ask you one question. On the average, how long did each photograph take?
The photography was 4 days for only, I think, 15 pictures. That's insane, right?
Wow.
That's
right.
insane. I never knew, I really never knew how intense it was. And now I'm involved in food photography for Hain Celestialum. I'm with the people when they photograph the frozen food boxes, and I see what's involved now. I mean, it's really special photographers. It's food.
Of course.
You know, I mean, food stylists.
All the problems of lighting, sometimes you get a perfect angle, and there is suddenly an ungainly shadow in the wrong place.
Yep.
You have to soften
and
it.
And
you have to get rid of it.
Right, Chaim, a lot of companies used to use a lot of fake items. They would use shortening for ice cream and do things that worked well under the camera. Well, like a company
of
like...
I remember when I lived in Israel about 30-some years ago, in my studio, whenever we were doing ice cream, instead of ice cream, we were using potato puree.
Exactly.
With some artificial color.
Exactly. Exactly.
And it looked great on the camera. It looked great on the photo. You never would have known that this was not an ice cream, but, hey, there's quite a few things like that we use. For example, for beer with the foam, we would put in some Jell-O, and on top of it, we would put in some shaving cream and fix it up a little bit to make it look like the foam on top of the beer. I mean, there were a lot of such tricks that we did in the olden days. Today, thank God, with digital camera, we don't have to resort to that. We can be much more natural. And
exactly.
The results are far, far better.
And I think, honestly, I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't have done that with my cookbooks. And also, Hain, the company Hain, is the leader in natural and organics, and they wouldn't allow any of the, any. They want truth in advertising. If they're going to show a picture of something, they want to go to sleep at night and know that this is true and this is what it really looks like, and we're not trying to fool the consumer into thinking it looks like something else. Because do you ever go to the supermarket, seriously, and get something? The box, the photography looks amazing. You take it home, you open it, and you say,
right, and it's terrible.
Yeah,
In the olden days, there was an excuse because we did not have today's lights, today's fast lights. What we had was the super hot lights, and let's face it, ice cream doesn't last very long under very hot lights. It melts immediately.
Right. And
so
you, this,
we had
this
to
is
use
your
type
field.
Of tricks.
This is your
yeah.
field. I mean, you're very involved with it. I know that because I remember how you are with your pictures and your website and everything that you do. Is magnificent. I remember commenting you on that.
Thank you.
Saying, you know, I thought you know, you just was some guy with a camera taking pictures, and I didn't realize this is your background. This is what you do.
Mm-hmm.
You do a great job of it. You're a Da Vinci in your own right. You're a Da Vinci in your own right.
Thank you. Not quite. I will be happy when I will be called the Jeff Nathan of photography. Then I know I'll have arrived.
Does everybody who's listening know that I'm paying you to say this?
Now, let's talk about Passover. It's almost here. And I understand that you will have the Seder's at the restaurant, and you also have special menus.
Yes. Yes,
now,
we have.
Now, let me ask you one question. Are the menus with gebrocks or non-gebrocks? And can somebody who normally eats non-gebrocks be accommodated?
The menu is gebrocks. So, no.
The menu is with gebrocks. Okay.
Yes.
I understand. Can you tell us some of the highlights of the menu?
So we have a communal Seder from the Chabad here in Midtown, and then we also have mini Seders. Families are coming, and they're doing their own Seders. You know, the Seder menu, you have a choice of soup, salad, and entree and dessert. And, of course, everything is involved, you know, with all the rituals and the wine and the grape juice and everything. There's a lot of classics. You know, I do have gefilte fish, except I do it with a twist. You know, I serve it with a little beet and balsamic salad and a little carrot salad and a remoulade of a duo of different horseradishes. So I twist it up a little bit. But I'll tell you the truth. When it comes to classics and standards and things, whether it's Rosh Hashanah or what have you, I like to keep things originally the way they were. I don't need to. I experiment every other day of the year. I think classics are there for a reason, and there's no reason to play with it too much. So when it's time to serve the classics, I like to serve the classics. If you're going to serve a chicken soup, you serve a nice, good chicken soup, a gefilte fish the right way. But, of course, I have beautiful aged 16-ounce dry-aged ribeyes, you know, for the seders also you can have, or a roulade of chicken. And then for Chol HaMoed, it's just a regular menu. One of the nice dishes on that menu is the dish that you said you like, the veal Milanese, veal cutlet, breaded in, I like to call it panko flakes, but it's really a combination of different size pieces of matzo farfel with Italian herbs and seasonings, fried crisp.
Does it taste as good as your normal panko?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I really do.
I use it quite a bit.
Yeah, same here.
After
I love
discovered
it
first on your website, I became an habitué. I mean, I have to use it as much as I can get away with it.
Thank you.
And I find a lot of excuses for using it.
Yeah. I mean, I love it. I love the crispiness of it. I like the crunchiness of it. And I serve that with an heirloom tomato salad, which is beautiful. It's delicious. You know, a lot of nice dishes. I mean, it's very difficult to open Passover. If everyone understands how hard it is to make the home Pesach, just imagine a 375-seat restaurant.
Right. Especially since you have to do it almost at the last minute anyway.
Exactly.
You can't close a restaurant.
No, every day, this past week, every day, slowly but surely, we've been getting the place ready. Tomorrow is my last day I'm open. I'm koshering the restaurant on Friday all day. And then we're open Sunday, Pesach, but with a regular menu. So it's a regular menu, but Pesach. And then Monday and Tuesday, we have the Seders. And then Thursday, we have Chol HaMoed. And then Friday, we're open for lunch. And then Sunday for lunch. And then I pass out.
And you never open on Saturday nights, huh?
Well, 6 months of the year we do, but when the clocks change, we open Friday lunch.
When the clocks change, I got it. I understand.
Exactly. So right now, I mean, March 12th was our last Saturday, and now we're open lunches on Friday.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If it wasn't for Shabbos, we wouldn't have any time to rest.
If it wasn't for Shabbos, most of us would not be alive.
You know what? You're right. You are right.
By the time Shabbos comes around, I'm totally exhausted. I mean, all the sleep that I gave up during the week suddenly comes with a vengeance on Shabbos, you know?
Chaim, I'm telling you, I agree with you. I am exhausted by the time Shabbos comes. I am put in a very busy week. The rest is well-deserved. It's a time for family. It's really nice.
Another thing I like, which I also first saw on your website, was your knives.
Oh, thank you.
They are very, very good. I like the shapes. I like the way they cut. They're superb knives. I mean, I depend almost completely on them now. I barely use any of my other knives.
You know what? Let me tell you something. I tell everybody about that knife. It's so reasonable. All these other knives that you can get online or at the store, they're so expensive, and they get dull. And most homemakers don't know how to sharpen a knife proper. I developed this knife. It's inexpensive. It's idiot-proof. It's shaped. You were mentioning the shape. It's curved in such a way that it makes it very easy to work with. I love them. And they're all available. You know, that and the Panko are all available on my website.
Absolutely. That's how I first learned of them.
Right.
Well, we've reached the end of the show. Thank you very, very much for gracing us with your presence.
Oh, my
As
pleasure.
Always,
Thank
it's a
you.
Pleasure talking to you, Chef.
Thank you.
And I'll be seeing you as a regular customer soon.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, and have a happy Passover.
Chag Kasher v'Sameach.
Take care. Bye-bye now.
Good night, ladies and gentlemen. We will be back the Wednesday immediately after Passover, where our guest will be Chef Sarah Lasry, author of 2 cookbooks, former restaurateur, and currently the food editor of Bina Magazine. It's been a pleasure spending the last 2 hours with you. Thank you very, very much. Have a Chag Kasher v'Sameach, a very happy Passover. Enjoy your meal with the family, and we will see you immediately after on April the 27th. Thank you very much, and good night. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene.